I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people about the moral case for capitalism and the importance of having faithful Catholics run for office. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. It's common for candidates to make a big deal out of their religious affiliations, at least at election time. When the voting is over, however, it's just as common for them to put faith on the shelf and go about day-to-day political business in ways that seem to have very little to do with God or transcendent beliefs. In a nation with no established church, how important is it that our leaders be faithful people? And even if politicians try to live their lives by biblical principles, can their personal faith have genuine impact? Tommy Valentine represents an organization called Catholic Vote. This group is committed to the idea that faith matters in the work of governing. They want to get more Catholics running for office, and they want citizens to bring conscience into their decisions about whom to vote for. Tommy's been with us before, and he's here again. Thanks for taking time to talk with us about this.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
There's no question that our society is in a period of moral decline, and that certainly affects our politics. But can practicing Catholics really make a difference?
Well, absolutely they can, and not only can they, but they must, right? So it's our obligation as Catholics. The Catechism says clearly that it's actually our moral obligation to vote. It's not just something we can do or that we should do. It's something that we're obligated to do, and that's something the Church has made clear for centuries. Even beyond that, beyond our obligations as Catholics, it's also our obligation as Americans, right, for religious people to be involved in the process. You know, I was reading a book just last night about the Founding Fathers, and there were quotes that I had heard before, but they hit me in a new way just as an adult. You know, I hadn't read these since I was a teenager, when John Adams said that the Constitution is for a moral and religious people and wholly unsuited to any other, or that George Washington said that religion and morality are indispensable supports to a nation, and that we require religious obligation out of our elected officials. So it's not just our obligation as Catholics, it's our obligation as citizens to vote our consciences, to use our religious faith to inform the way that we engage in the public square.
How do we discern whether a candidate's faith commitment is real? After all, abortion advocates like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi claim to be good Catholics.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I think it's really interesting. So there's a couple different types of politicians that we see. So there are politicians that don't necessarily claim a particular faith, or they're sort of ambiguously Christian, but they don't really talk about it much. And I would put Donald Trump in that category. And then you have politicians like Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, who actively pledge adherence to the Catholic faith, and then publicly they work against it in direct contradiction to it. And in Pelosi's case, and to a lesser extent Joe Biden, they will actually cite their Catholic faith in support of things that the Church abhors and condemns, such as abortion. You know, Nancy Pelosi, there's a famous clip of her at a press conference a number of years ago when she was asked how she reconciled Catholic faith with abortion. And she actually said that abortion was a sacred issue to her. And as a Catholic, it was extremely important to her. So, you know, the politicians who cite their faith in supporting the most detestable things that you can imagine, an abortion, and transgenderism, and all these things that violate human dignity, I don't know there's worse things than that when it comes to public policy.
We have a long tradition. I don't know that it's officially recognized, but it's certainly something that's been around for a while, that the two things you don't talk about in polite society are politics and religion. And this, of course, involves both. How can you get people past that? How can you encourage people to actually look into the religious lives of candidates and make some sound moral judgments?
Yeah, you know, that's a saying that everybody's familiar with, and I really think it's a fallacy, because religion affects every aspect of somebody's life, right? And if somebody's religious faith is not evident in the way they speak and the way they live, it may be a sign that it's not that important to them. And I think what we're seeing, just to get a little bit more existential or philosophical here, is that politics is really replacing religion for a lot of people. You know, people who identify as secular or atheist or spiritual but not religious, we see really kind of a religious devotion to certain ideologies on the left or certain political beliefs. There are dogmas you're not allowed to question, like the idea that, you know, somebody who is a man can identify as a woman, and you're just not allowed to question them on that. There's a lot of religious sort of practices that sort of infect people who renounce religion. They're practicing it just as much as everybody else. They just won't admit it. But more broadly, I mean, religion is something that you don't check at the door when you enter a polling place. It's something that you shouldn't check at the door when you enter a workplace. It's something where you should be using it as a witness, especially for us as Catholics. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're called to stand up in the cafeteria and give a speech about your faith. You know, that wouldn't even be effective even if you did that. But the way that you believe and your faith as a Catholic should be evident in the way that you speak and in the way that you live. And so it's important for us to take that understanding into the polling place, to not say that my faith and my politics are separate and, you know, I go to church on Sunday, but I vote in whatever accordance with what I think is best. It should really be about, okay, my religion informs me of these things, of these questions on moral issues that shape my conscience, and I need to listen to that when I vote and when I work in the public square.
It does seem like the left fears religion. I know I'm seeing all kinds of articles and Facebook posts and memes about the great specter of Christian nationalism. That seems to be the big boogeyman right now. Why do you think that religious faith strikes terror into the hearts of people on the left?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, and we saw a very strange example of this, although I guess it's not so strange anymore, when Politico, which is a major publication that a lot of people probably haven't heard of or haven't read, but is very widely read, especially in D.C. Politicians read it all the time. It covers sort of the inside baseball of what goes on Capitol Hill in D.C. as well as state capitals around the country. And the author of this article wrote a long-form piece about the, like you said, the specter of Christian nationalism. It sort of framed the whole idea as these radical Christians believe that rights come from God, not from government. And it was like being in the Twilight Zone, because up until, you know, the past 10, 20 years, every child would have learned that in school, and everybody would have believed it, right? Because if rights don't come from God, well, where do they come from? Well, then if they do come from the government, then that means the government can take them away just as easily as they can grant them. And so we protested, we sent a letter to Politico, and then a few days later, the author wrote a long piece sort of trying to clarify what she meant, and it rang kind of hollow to us. But yeah, more broadly, I mean, I think ultimately secularism and atheism, I think, boils down to a lack of humility. The idea that somebody can be absolutely confident that there is no God and that I don't have to be bound by anything but my own moral conscience,
right,
and that I set the rules, and that if I'm following my truth, then I'm doing okay. Now, the irony of it is that we're raised in Western civilization. We have an inheritance that's been passed down to us over the last 2,000 years. Christianity and Catholicism, more specifically, have thoroughly shaped our culture, right? Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement seems to have really shaped a lot of the way people think, and that racism is a bad thing, and that discrimination is a bad thing. Well, where does that idea come from? You know, the Greeks didn't believe that. The Chinese didn't believe that. Japanese, the Indians, even the Romans, nobody believed that. It was the Catholic Church that pushed that issue, and it was people of religious faith, from Martin Luther King to priests around the country, who pushed the idea that, no, racism is bad. Segregation is bad. You shouldn't discriminate against people. Why? Because every person is made in the image and likeness of God, and every person has dignity. And so what they try to do is separate that notion out from religion without realizing that without Christianity and the Catholic faith, they probably wouldn't have that notion. Because like I said, this was novel. It's not something that other civilizations have come up with. And so I think it's ultimately a worship of the self, and that to thine own self be true, and that you don't need to be held accountable to any outside force, that as long as you're a good person living by your own truth, then you're okay. I think the idea of being accountable to a creator and to a church is really frightening for some of these people. And so that's why they run away from it.
Well, what are you guys up to, especially in this election year? Are you out beating the bushes for prospective Catholic politicians?
Yeah, we're working hard right now. We just had some meetings earlier this week about how we're going to tackle things this year. We're working on some very exciting projects. We want to work with Catholics around the country and even going beyond Catholics to people of other faiths to understand the issues. We just released an ad on immigration a couple weeks ago, really calling attention to the human tragedy that's going on there. You know, you hear the words humanitarian crisis. I don't think people realize the full extent of it. And I didn't realize the full extent of it until recently about what goes on down at the border. We're talking about these hundreds of thousands and millions of people who are crossing the border are really being smuggled by human traffickers. And there are things that I won't even say on your air because I know this is going on public radio that would absolutely horrify and devastate people. But I'll leave it at human trafficking, and that includes child trafficking.
Sure.
And this is being actively aided and abetted by the United States government. The United States government is actively aiding human traffickers. There are 80,000 children who have presented at the border over the last few years of the Biden administration that the government has lost track of. We have no idea where they are. They could be back in the U.S. All of them are recycled back to Mexico so that illegal immigrants who are crossing can claim that person as their child, because if you have a child, you're treated differently. And so a lot of these kids are used by a random adult to present to the border to say, I have a child, let me in. And then they get sent back over the border back to Mexico to be recycled and used by another adult. It's just travesty upon travesty, and the Biden administration is doing nothing about it. And so we're calling for action, not because we dislike immigrants or not because we believe that they're not valuable to our society. Like, everybody understands that. But the fact that human trafficking is occurring on the border with the support of the federal government is absolutely wrong, and it needs to stop. So we're working to educate Catholics and people of all faiths on those issues, and we are definitely vetting candidates right now and working with good Catholic candidates around the country to support them in their races for offices up and down the ballot.
Well, if people want to find out more about your work or tap into some of this information that you're accumulating, where can they go?
CatholicVote.org, and they can also sign up for The Loop, which is our daily email-based newsletter. It tells you everything you need to know about what's going on in the United States, the world, and in the church. It really merges secular news with Catholic news, and it can be read in 5 minutes. So you can sign up for that on our website.
CatholicVote.org. Tommy Valentine, thanks very much for taking time to talk with us.
I appreciate it, Bill. Thank you.
It's likely that just about everyone in America has heard the name Adam Smith at some time or other. It's equally likely that most people don't know who Adam Smith was or why they should know about him. Adam Smith was an 18th century Scottish philosopher who looked very deeply into the workings of business and labor and trade and money. He's often referred to as the father of capitalism. But there's more to the Adam Smith story than that, and the Indiana-based Liberty Fund has a program called the Adam Smith Works, whose mission is to make Adam Smith and his writings more widely known. Sarah Squire handles communications for that effort, and she's with us now. Sarah, thanks for taking time to tell us about Adam Smith.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
In a nutshell, why is Adam Smith important?
Well, it's hard to put Adam Smith in a nutshell to answer that question. As you said so nicely in your introduction, he's often thought of as the father of capitalism, or more broadly, the father of modern economics. And indeed, his book, The Wealth of Nations, for which he's probably best known, which is having an anniversary coming up in 2026, it will be the 250th anniversary of the publication of The Wealth of Nations, that's the book for which Adam Smith is best known. But Smith wrote another big, and I would argue equally important, book before that, that's called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which outlines Smith's moral philosophy. And before he did that, he was a teacher of rhetoric and belles lettres. So he's a little bit hard to nail down in the best sort of 18th century way.
He was more than an economist, as you say. He was a moral philosopher, and he brought a decidedly moral perspective to all of these concerns.
Absolutely. And one of Smith's big observations, or I think the thing for which he's best known in moral philosophy, is his notion that we build character through sympathy with others. Smith uses the word sympathy in his work because the word empathy had not yet been invented. So when I say sympathy, it's because it's the word that Smith uses, but modern listeners might want to translate that in their heads to empathy. And what Smith says is that by learning to sympathize with the joys and the sorrows of other people, we learn to moderate our own responses to the joys and sorrows in our own lives. We watch other people, we study our reactions to them, thereby we learn what is appropriate for our own choices and for our own lives. And I think that's really beautiful.
How does that factor into his explanation about the workings of the market and the economy?
Well, that's probably the question for Adam Smith's studies. For a long time, people argued that there were essentially two Adam Smiths, that there was this guy who had written this book on moral philosophy that's about sympathy, that's about connection with other people, and then he sort of takes a break and comes back and writes this book about economics and about capitalism that's just about making money and getting rich and accruing profit. We don't think that that is true anymore. And I would argue that one of the things that is important about the way Adam Smith thinks about the market is that while he does appreciate it for the way that market competition drives us to improve, he also sees the way in which a market for good and a market for services allows us to help one another, and allows us to help one another whether we necessarily intend to or not. One of his most famous lines from The Wealth of Nations is that it's something I'm quoting from memory, so forgive me if I don't get it precisely right, that it is not from the benevolence of the butcher or the baker that we receive our bread and meat, it's from their following their own self-interest, which is to say, very few people go into business baking bread or butchering meat or brewing beer because out of the goodness of their heart, they just want to feed everybody, right? That's right. The province of charity, right? That's the province of churches, of temples, of other institutions like that. People go into business because they're good at baking bread or brewing beer or butchering meat, and they know that they can make money and feed their family and support themselves by engaging in that occupation. But because they engage in that occupation, the rest of us have bread, and the rest of us have meat, and the rest of us have beer.
Right?
And so we pursue our own good ends, but we also provide for the good ends of other people.
Right. People give money specifically because they have wants and needs, and business satisfies those wants and needs.
Exactly. And it satisfies it more efficiently than a straight barter economy, which is often something people want to suggest as an alternative to capitalism or to a market economy, right? They want to suggest that we should return to a barter economy. Well, the problem with a barter economy is that if I happen to be a very good knitter and I have mittens that I would like to trade for things, I have to find somebody who has what I want who also needs mittens.
Right.
And that's much less efficient than a market economy where the people who have what I want are happy to accept money in exchange for the thing that I want. And then they can use that money to get whatever they want. It's a shorthand for a barter economy.
Yeah, this moral aspect of capitalism is often misunderstood or completely ignored by people whose hearts may be in the right place. They may wish to help the poor or improve society or whatever, but somehow they don't make this connection.
Right. And certainly Smith is never going to say, don't help the poor. But he is going to remind us not to denigrate the good work and the excellent work that is done by business people all over the world who are primarily working to make their businesses run better and who produce better products for us and better services for us and at lower and lower cost over time.
How were his views received at the time? Did people get his argument then?
Smith was wildly popular at the time. He was an enormously popular lecturer and teacher. And we know this because we have a lot of student notes from his classes.
Hmm.
And we actually have a description of Smith's lecture from James Boswell, the great biographer of Samuel Johnson, which makes my English professor heart just full of glee. And his book sold exceptionally well. There's a really fun piece of correspondence, a letter from David Hume to Adam Smith. And Smith has obviously been asking Hume, you know, while you're in London, can you look into how my book is selling? Are people buying and reading Wealth of Nations, right? What's going on? And Hume writes Adam Smith a long letter during which he keeps saying, oh, and I keep meaning to tell you how your book is doing. And then he interrupts himself and talks about something else for three paragraphs, pretends he's going to get back to the book, interrupts himself again, and just keeps Smith on tenterhooks all the way through it, and concludes by saying, I've terrible news for you about your book. It's selling really well, and you're about to become popular.
Smith was writing at the time of the American Revolution. What was his influence on this side of the pond?
Certainly, Smith was influential on this side of the pond. He also had a lot to say about colonies and about the American colonies in specific. He was not a supporter of the colonial project and thought that, in general, colonies made everybody less wealthy and everybody less free. So he was largely a supporter of the American effort to free themselves from England's colonial project and of the efforts of other colonies to free themselves as well. And certainly his praise for the market economy and his anti-mercantilist discussions in the Wealth of Nations were a big hit over on this side of things as well.
Today we're in an atmosphere where the ideas of socialism have sort of gained new life. A lot of people are questioning our traditional approach to a market economy. They want to make changes in it, or they want to abolish it altogether. What does Adam Smith have to say to the folks at this time?
I think that Smith is a good and interesting counterpoint to these kinds of arguments, because when you actually read what Smith puts on the page, rather than reading, say, a canned version of Adam Smith, or taking for granted the things that people say about Smith, you find that he is, for example, anti-colonialist. You find that he does, for example, talk about how difficult it can be for workers when bosses try to create monopolies or when they collude about prices and collude about wages, right? He talks about the importance of the small shop owner being able to get started out. And he speaks directly about the incredible grinding poverty that is the result of small communities where it is necessary to be self-sufficient. So he talks about the crofters in the Scottish Highlands, who at the time were enormously isolated, and their need to produce everything that their families consume, and their need to be not just farmers, but also woodworkers and also metal workers and also cloth makers and everything else that you can think of, they're trying to produce on their own small crofts. This is the sort of lifestyle, I think, that is often romanticized by people who have a yen for either the romance of earlier times or the romance of the socialist project, right? Well, this is grinding poverty. And he's able to sort of stand in the middle of the time and the country where there are still people living like this and say, nobody wants to live like this anymore. And we see how much wealthier we are when we are able to have a market economy that is powered by the division of labor, that is powered by our ability to specialize and become really good at things.
And link distant areas to and trade between different places that produce different kinds of products can meet everybody's needs.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to read Smith because he is, of course, a strong supporter of trade and of what trade can do for us. But, you know, Smith is writing before the railroad even. So when he's thinking about trade, he's thinking primarily of carriage over land and carriage over sea. Trade hasn't even really, I mean, the sea trade, of course, has opened up enormously when Smith is writing, but we haven't seen the miracle of the railroad for trade and for transport.
So he was really something of a prophet then. He was looking ahead.
He was, and he's, you know, when he writes about factories, he's writing at the very, very earliest hints of an industrial revolution,
right?
Right? We haven't had the big mills of Manchester. We haven't had, like, real factories kick in. When Smith is talking about factories, he's talking about small workshop factories.
Mm-hmm.
18 people, 25 people, not 400.
Right.
And it's fascinating to see that he's able to look around when he's writing and see the improvements that are already occurring with these small increases in specialization and division of labor. It would have been amazing, right, had he been able to live to be 150 years old, it would have been amazing to see what he would have made of the Industrial Revolution. I don't think it would have been all positive, but it would have been amazing to see what he would have made of it.
Well, where can people find out more about your programs and the publications and everything associated with the Adam Smith Works?
If people are interested in finding a whole lot more of material on Adam Smith and having access to Adam Smith's writings, they can visit adamsmithworks.org, O-R-G, at the end of the URL, where they will find pretty much endless articles, podcasts, blog posts, and the full text of Smith's works. All of it is available. All of it is free to access. We just want to share it with people because we love Smith and his works and his world, and we would like other people to learn to love him as well.
Sarah Squire of the Liberty Fund, thanks very much for taking time to talk about a figure that has been incredibly important in our history and really deserves to be known better.
Thank you. Obviously, I can't stop talking about him hardly. I don't think I've let you get a word in edgewise, and I appreciate the invitation and the patience.
Don't forget to support your local Catholic radio station. In this time of censorship and so-called cancel culture, Catholic radio is becoming increasingly important as an alternative media source. Our programming is based on the Word of God and the teaching of His Church, and we bring you the factual, truthful information you aren't getting from the mainstream media. Support Catholic Radio. Your generosity keeps Catholic outlets on the air, and donations to broadcast ministries can be tax-deductible. Urge your friends and relatives to tune in as well. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.